So hello, hello, welcome to FEPS Talk, the podcast of the Foundation for European Progressive Studies. Today, with Tony Habstrut, chairing Global Politics, School of Social Sciences, University of Manchester. So before we start our talk, I would like to give the floor to Tony to present herself, and then later on I will present myself. So Tony, please, the floor is yours, and thank you very much for joining us in this podcast.
Thank you so much, Lena, for having me on to the FEPS podcast. As Lena has said, everyone, my name is Tony Hastrup. I'm a professor at the University of Manchester in the UK. And there I do some research on, I guess, broadly feminist international politics, where I have more recently focused on feminist foreign policy, which is why I guess we're here. But I also do some work on the women, peace and security agenda. And in particular there, I'm sort of looking at the relationship between global North countries and global South countries, as well as looking at the ways in which feminist movements, particularly in Africa, have taken up this issue of women, peace and security, but peace and security more broadly, specifically from a sort of Afro-feminist perspective.
So thank you. It is, I think the podcast come to the right time, because everything that is happening in the world, world peace is becoming far, far away. More time, and also the importance that the Global South is taking and need to take in this global agenda on peace and security, and obviously how feminist movement we have to be there. So let me introduce myself, who I am also here. I'm interested on that. I'm Vice President of FEPS. I'm the chair of FEPS Scientific Council. But I'm also a university professor myself, Economy, History and Institutions chair at the University Pablo de la Vida in Seville, where I was specialized on feminist studies, especially feminist economics. But since 2019, I'm a member of the European Parliament from the Progressive Alliance of Socialists and Democrats. And since 2024, I'm also the chair of the Committee on Women's Rights on Gender Equality. So as well, really trying to move on the agenda, the feminist agenda I have always done in my life, before more from academics and now more in politics, but also all the time to trying that knowledge. It is basic for decision making in politics, but also among citizens, and obviously for transforming the world in a better world, and especially a better world for women. So let's start our conversation. In this moment that I was saying before is more needed than ever before, probably because too many things are really changing. The multilateralism that we thought it will not change, this relationship between North and the global South, and rules that we thought were here to stay are not anymore working. So many things are changing at the same time. But what is not changing is that women, we are not in those decision-making places as we supposed to be in relationship with our weight within the population, and especially power, the distribution of power, and the way we think militarism instead of security is still going in a very male dominated way. So why for that we have a feminist foreign policy as a tool? But Tony, if there is someone that is listening to us, say what enough is feminist foreign policy, how you will tell them, what you will tell them, what it's about, and why it is important, especially what is so important in the moment we are going through now. So please.
Thank you so much, Lena. I'm very curious to hear the answer to that question from you as well. But I guess when I'm thinking about feminist foreign policy, the thing I say when, especially when I'm describing it to my students, is that it's one approach to foreign policy. But despite the ambitions of feminists, I think it's always really important to be cautious, or at least I try to be cautious from the very onset, that feminist foreign policy itself does not necessarily lead to transformation, but it potentially creates pathways that might lead to transformation. So it is one approach to foreign policy. And I think this is really important because actually I feel that in the optimism towards feminist foreign policy since 2014, which is when Sweden declared the first feminist foreign policy, I think we've focused a lot on the feminist part because we're feminists and less so on the foreign policy part. And I think that's really important, especially to understand what is happening in the current moment, but to also to help us move on, I guess, from some of the disappointment. And so what does that actually mean? Foreign policy is an instrument of the state. And states operate within a system of power, a system of hierarchy, a system of borders, and often one of militarization, as you stated earlier. So how can we make this system that is endemically hierarchical actually feminist? And the argument that I have made in my own work is to suggest that I don't think actually that we can have feminist foreign policy, but we can have feminist informed policies. So foreign policy itself, I don't think can be feminist, given that my understanding of feminism seeks liberation. And in that context of liberation, a lot of these issues that I've highlighted, borders, power, militarization, do not exist. So what is it that feminist foreign policy, because there is still something that some people call feminist foreign policy, and I don't think we can ignore that. What is this thing that is called feminist foreign policy? I think what that thing is that it has helped to, in a sense, normalize a feminist analysis of foreign policy more systematically, not just something we do within universities, but something that civil society takes up, something that states take up. It has helped us ask questions around who can be in what spaces, as you mentioned earlier. It is still the case that women are absent from the spaces of decision making. And it's not just about the representation of women, but the ability to actually be able to decide on things. But at the same time, I also think that, despite what I might call caution or the need for caution when thinking about feminist foreign policy, I think it has opened up the space for thinking more about gender responsive and sort of justice oriented policy, even across a range of issues like climate change, for example, helping us rethink what security could potentially mean. So, in that sense, I would say that feminist foreign policy, or FFP, as we know it, is a normative lens and potentially an accountability framework, particularly in those states that are already sort of defining feminist foreign policy. It is true, and I think again it's fair to say that while it might not dismantle global hierarchies in of itself, it does create a pathway through which we can hold states accountable when they declare their feminism. It does provide an entry point for us to rethink alternatives to dominant paradigms within international relations. But as I said earlier, I am actually quite keen to hear how you think about feminist foreign policy in general, but also in the context of your own political work.
So thank you. Thank you very much, Tony. I see your point on saying, well, there is no such a thing as a feminist foreign policy, but people identify making feminism within foreign policy as a feminist foreign policy. So I see that point, and of course, it will not lead directly to transform foreign policies, but pathways to do it. But the goal has to be to transform. I mean, I know it is extremely ambitious because at the end, what we are talking about is to transform power itself. And power itself, we know it is designed as a male, in a male way, with male experience, with a male history and their time, the way they are socialized, everything is a very masculine power still. So why women empower in different aspects of power are either behaving as societies consider male, or saying, well, like it has seen the art and say, well, I'm out because I'm exhausted. I mean, I cannot be anymore here. So I also, as you know, there are many studies saying that unless there is an important percentage of women on those institutions, we cannot behave and cannot change things. So why, yes, the feminist polling policy is obviously not about having more women ambassadors, but if we manage to have much more women on those spaces, definitely they will be few of them that want to transform, and they will be able to do it in a different way. If there are just few, they are gonna be considered just an exception. The capacity to transform will be really limited, and leading finally to this kind of social depletion because of the multiple roles. So that is how I see it, and to distinguish what we can do, and the goal, the definition should be to transform. Is like when I'm doing it, feminist economics is the same. Obviously, I will not dream or not think that the economy will change and the productive addiction and that we have will change from one day to another. But yes, I want where I would like to arrive. How? It is very difficult because, as you said, there are different pathways, and this idea you were also introducing about global south and not thinking only diplomacy and feminist foreign policy from a Western vision, it is very important because what we are demonstrating as well is that there are also different roles, and also of including women and feminist perspective on this international relations, this foreign policy, and this peace and security agenda, which indeed need absolutely women there, even to put on the table on the negotiations aspects that otherwise are not really treated, and the usual suspect probably normally it is sexual violence as and rape as a weapon for war and conflict, but not only, also taking care and some infrastructure could be another issue that normally will not be taken into consideration unless we include this vision. So very briefly, and now at the European Union level, at least here in Parliament, and obviously what is happening here in Parliament, it is reflected in a way to what is doing or not the Commission. We are having some struggle and some problem to move on this idea of feminist foreign policy. Sometimes it's just because a question of language. Because not all words, like gender, for instance, can be easily be translated in certain languages or certain context, cultural context, and they generate a big reaction. Sometimes it's that, but that at the end could be reinforcing the gender backlash we are seeing. One third of the actual European Parliament, it is occupied by members that deny the existence of gender-based violence. They have a clear anti-gender agenda. And so these things are going on at the same time. It depends on the nationalities, as I was saying. So now we don't have majority to include the terminology of feminist foreign policy in any of the documents going out from Parliament, not even gender transformative actions in our foreign policy, even if we will continue in the GAP4, in the gender external action of the European Union, to maintain most of the things that were in GAP3, and we hope we will manage to advance on it, but with a lot of struggle. And I would like you to know how you see also this gender backlash in general in international relations. And with a lot of struggle and a lot of reaction towards the word feminism in itself. I always said that it is probably because there is a big struggle against democracy, and feminism is the absolutely most radical movement within democracy all over the 20th century and the 21st century. And if you want to empty or to weaken democracy, you have to go against feminism. And now my voice is started. So.
Wow, Lena, we could be here all afternoon talking about all of those issues that you've raised, you know. So, been working with UN Women, looking at women in diplomacy, and especially in the context of the multilateral system. And you're absolutely right that, you know, we do need women to be in those spaces where the big decisions are being made. And what you see in the sort of patterns of who becomes ambassadors and where they become ambassadors and what portfolios they have before they're able to become ambassadors is we still sort of see an active, so, you know, socialized way of preventing women from taking these positions of power. So even while I fundamentally would still say representation is not everything, but I think we cannot deny the fact that there is no reason to exclude women from all of the spaces. And if we're not seeing sort of the numbers we would expect in terms of numbers alone, then we know something else is going on. And I think one of the things that I find concerning, and I think that's a concern of a lot of feminists, so I'm not unique there, but I think especially feminists in the international relations space, is the fact that, yes, we do have an anti-gender backlash. And I often, you know, in those moments of hope, I always try to make people understand that, you know, this is not the first time that we're having anti-gender backlash for sure. And there are stories we can tell as well about the days before Gap 3, the days before we even had any gap, the days before we, you know, try to convince folks to move gender equality from the realm of just employment within the EU to the realm of development first, and to then convince folks, you know, 8 years after the Women, Peace and Security agenda, that it's okay for the European Union to have some sort of framework that kind of acknowledges that. And I remember clearly the consultations we did towards the strategic approach in 2018. And so it is certainly extremely disheartening that we're still here in 2026, struggling to even get those feminist principles that we feel like we have already won. So I think there is a vulnerability at the moment to sort of feminist inclusion. And that vulnerability we've already seen, of course, in the retrenchment of feminist foreign policy itself. But I also say to folks that whatever sort of disappointment we feel with respect to retrenchment in some states, like Sweden, who was the originator, we cannot look away from some of the progress that we've seen around feminist foreign policy. And again, that link to democracy that we've seen in countries like Spain, for example, like Colombia, for example. So I think we cannot despair too much because there are spaces of hope. At the same time, when we look at these instances of retrenchment, I think that it tells us that, yes, feminist work is not easy and that we cannot afford to give up. I agree with you, Lena, completely, that if you want to see, if you want to gauge the quality of democracy, look at how gender concerns are being treated. As feminists, we say all the time, gender is not just an issue for women. And we know that. We think that, we've inculcated that into the minds of folks. But look at what is actually happening in the world, the ways in which sort of muscular masculinity is reinforcing itself in the realm of security, the current context of our world right now. So, we're expected to accept what our leaders tell us about the sacrifices we have to make for the current geopolitical moment, when we know that there is no consistency, when we know that there is no consistency that facilitates sort of democratic ends towards gaining a more peaceful international system. What we see is an increase in arms exports, which again is really tied to masculinities and increased militarizations, security partnerships with abusive regimes in the name of security, where peace feels like a swear word, frankly. We are moving into this. I read an article the other day where the author was sort of saying, we are moving into an almost unrecognizable world, and we are being told that it's being done in the name of security. And of course, we know that that means that it limits the space that feminist ideals can thrive. But I guess for me, and again, this is linked to the work that I've been doing in terms of the relationship between the global North and the global South, I think the situation we find ourselves where we kind of have this sort of anti-gender mobilizations on steroid will simply serve to fracture even more the relationships between countries in the global North and the global South for one main reason. For years and years, countries in the global South have been told that the rules-based order is the gold standard to governance everywhere. And yet, in the last 4 years, the most powerful countries have effectively thrown everything that we've been taught to believe about the rules-based order. And here, almost no country in the so-called global north or powerful countries is exempt, including my own country here. So how do you make the case for two less mature democracies that these are the sets of rules that you should follow? And I think, again, one of the opportunities that thinking about feminism and international relations gives us is the ability to sort of make these connections and to make these connections honestly. And I think, I've been thinking recently, given that we are moving now this week into CSW, Committee on the Status of Women, where the theme for CSW 70 is access to justice. And I'm just wondering, how do we even begin to do that given the kinds of things that are being prioritized? So I guess I want to end there, Lena, by asking you, what do you think you're gonna take to CSW? Because I know that, that's something you're going to do soon. And how do we even begin to move towards achieving the goal of CSW 70? Because that's something that is also really close to my heart.
So Tony, before moving to the CSW precisely this year, that is access to justice, that it sounds like, well, what is going on? We are, yeah, we have to think. I mean, access to justice is important, and but there are other things that are going on, and they are very urgent. But you were mentioning without saying the word, but I will put that word about how the hypocrisy of the West, Western world is saying to the global south, to the rest of the world, that is the gold standard. And if something you need to achieve, and now it is West, or even the main, or the leader of the West, and the leader of what's so-called free world, that it is just not following any of those values, of those rules, and it is not only one. I'm just mentioning US, but obviously it's not only US, also UK, you mentioned your own country, European Union, in a way, as well. And while I was listening to you, it came to my mind this idea that the anti-woke extreme right, it is spreading all over the world, saying, well, you are imposing us among this global standard, this idea of gender equality, but this is foreign to our culture. That is, you got it in Russia, you got it in China, you got it in many other countries, now in the US. But last week, it was 2 weeks ago, sorry, I was listening the same here at the European Parliament. So I was saying, if here is also a foreign principle, where it's coming from? So it is everywhere. So they were saying, it is nowhere, it is not a foreign principle. I mean, it is a very basic principle, the principle of equality. So I think we really need to see with a certain perspective what is going on, and this how good this anti-gender movement are on changing the mindset and thinking everyone to think whatever they want to think. So this is not for us because it's a foreign idea. I said, oh, equality is a foreign idea here in Europe. And they were saying that without no trouble and no problem at all. So my idea on that is that the new economic and political elites don't need any more democracy. So capitalism needed democracy for many decades, but they don't need anymore. I mean, Peter Thiel and all these techno bros, they just don't need democracy anymore, and they want to get rid of democracy, and for that they need to get rid of feminism as well. And they are, as I was saying, they are changing also the minds, the set mind of many people in many countries in order really to change things.
No, it's so, it's such a challenging space to be really at the moment, because I think one of the things that we've seen, particularly with respect to this anti-gender mobilizations, is that it is having such a negative impact in Africa as well, where we've seen in countries like Senegal recently enacting laws that have nothing to do with like the everyday bread and butter issues that people actually have to struggle with, but sort of anti-LGBTQ laws, wanting to move, you know, laws that already criminalize LGBTQ people to even harsher punishments. And you ask yourself, but what is the motivation for this? Because most of the people going about their everyday work in offices, in the marketplace, are not sitting around and really asking, you know, but what are we going to do about these people? And they're really bothering us, given that, you know, frankly, because of other social stigma, the percentage of people who are out is actually quite minute in a lot of these countries. So it makes absolutely no sense. But what we do know is a lot of the funding and the mobilizations are coming from the global north, they're coming from the west, and they're partnering with conservatives in the case I know the most in Africa, to really sort of push this agenda. And part, a lot of it, of course, as we know, is fear mongering. And as we know, it is having actual implications on governance. So in Niger, the military junta, which is already antithetical to democracy, is able to pass this laws by saying, you know, it is against who we are. And it doesn't just, you know, we know, as we've seen anyway, globally, it doesn't just stop with LGBTQ people. So all those folks who might think, well, I'm not LGBTQ and I'm conservative anyway, it might be against whatever philosophical beliefs you have, they're not going to come for me. I think that's one of the more frustrating, I would say, intersections between my sort of academic and personal life. And I kind of want to yell, it's going to come at you, precisely for the reasons that you noted, Lena, which is that those who are in power no longer see the use for spaces of democratic deliberation. And for that reason, they are more than happy to get rid of whatever they think is standing in their way. And I guess, you know, from my part, I think the thing to also highlight is, it, you know, as horrible as the situation is, it also creates a space for feminist solidarity that is transnational. And that here is an opportunity to really listen. And, you know, I've been on a few webinars recently to really listen to sort of the feminist demands of Global South feminists, you know, feminists in Mexico, feminists in Uganda, you know, feminists in the DRC. And in a lot of ways, they've been saying the same things over and over and over again. And I think for us here who are based in the West, we've often taken advantage of, like, you know, things are just really bad over there. But here, look at everything that we have. Well, we no longer have all of those things anymore, and we are not better. We never actually have been, given what our own countries have been doing in all of those spaces. But I do think that, you know, rather than sort of going back on what may have happened, particularly amongst within sort of our feminist concerns, this is a moment for global solidarity. Like, we need to be in the fight together now. So even if we're leveraging things like access for justice, what does that mean in a transnational sense? So as terrible as the situation is, as the situation is that is bringing us together, I also think that it could potentially be an opportunity. But I guess I'm curious about what you're thinking for CSW.
No, I completely agree with you. I hope my voice stays with me the few minutes we still have for us. Yeah, I think what there is spaces for hope and obviously for fight, and we will be creating these complicities all over the globe, but because they have done it. I mean, this anti-gender movement move and works as an international, a fascist international, whatever you want to call it. As before, I was saying, I'm not extremely only attached to the anymore to the word feminist, but I'm a feminist, and I think it is. But I want things to move. And if there are some countries or some sisters everywhere that are not confident with that word, I'm happy to change in a way we can move on, all of us, with common goals. But they are working together as an international movement, and they are putting anti-feminism and anti-gender as a core issue for them, because, as I was saying before, because I think they are really against democracy. So what we have to do is to do exactly the same, but in the opposite direction. We cannot really keep looking to feminism and to gender equality as the top of the pie or the whatever. We really need to put it as a core issue, as a central issue, because unless we do that, pro-democracy, progressive movements, in academia, everywhere, unless we do that, we will be losing ground. Because for them, and I can see that very easily here in the European Parliament, it is a core issue. To instrumentalize for other, it doesn't matter. But they are either because of anti-democracy, either because they say now they are the real one protecting women and using gender as an instrument for the racist agenda, whatever it is. But the problem is the center because of demographic, because of many issues, is the center, the core. So we really need to do that as well. And for the CSW, we are bringing, I think, a quite an important a position, thinking that that could shape really global norms, and how important obviously is the access to justice in order to enforce the rights we have, and how it is important that there is access to justice for victims to go to justice and not re-victimize those victims for making justice all for women and for girls. And obviously, as a path to equality. As I was saying before, we are not bringing the word feminism to the CSW, but we are bringing the ideas and the goals that we have a majority for that. And I think we are prioritizing cooperation over domination, values on privation over militarization, centered on human security, and obviously sexual and reproductive health rights. So we managed to include it. We managed to go, although as I was saying before, not including either the word feminist or gender transformative, because there are not consensus over those words anymore within the European Parliament. But yes, we back the ideas, we back the principle, and we are still there. That in last year, for instance, CSW, it was a lot of appetite for the European Union and the role that the European Union must play. And now in the international arena on compromises and on fundings, because we know that the US aid cuts are very dangerous. There are many women's NGOs that will not survive this year. I've read estimations that around half of women's NGOs in the world will not survive. That means that there a lot of women and girls, the most vulnerable ones, will not survive either, because they will not have any more of that aid. And so this is something that we really, for me, I think that's the priority. And also the European Union is becoming more transactional in the international arena, unfortunately. So there's a struggle we have to make also here in Brussels, and not only in New York, but we have also to start continue to put pressure on making a priority for the European Union, because we are the mirror in which the US and other regimes don't want to show themselves or to mirror themselves. But we cannot become a US too. And we really need to stay strong in our values, in our core principles, and to translate it into real commitments in the international arena, in our external action, but also with funds, and not only because of transactional agreements. So I'm going with a lot of hope. Because I know I will find a lot of sisters and brothers that believe in inequality from all over the world with different visions, but I think a unique or a common goal. But I know this is going to be a tough one and a difficult one because probably we will have more anti-gender NGOs showing up there than pro-feminist NGOs that have no money to go.
Yes, I think we are. Just to reinforce that we're living in very, very sad times, unfortunately. I think, what you said earlier about, sometimes we can't use the word feminist. And I think that is something that I'm trying to make sense of myself. So I define very much myself as a feminist, but I also know that I work with a lot of other folks who share a lot of the same ambitions and who even those in civil society, they don't have feminism in their title because that wasn't how they were initially constituted, but they're engaged in feminist practices. And I think that's the thing that is really, really important, that there is, I'm part of a collective of African feminists, AFIP Collective, we call ourselves, so African Feminist Collective on Feminist Informed Policies. And we're very clear about our feminism. We're very clear about what it encompasses. But we engage with a range of different actors. And when you were just stating the different areas of priority that you're taking to CSW, I thought, well, that exactly matches on almost exactly based on the discussion we had earlier this year in our group in terms of what it is that we're going to be trying to do for the rest of the year, SRHR, thinking about human security, reducing militarization, really trying to engender the values of multilateralism again, even when we don't always, and I would say this quite frankly, we don't necessarily have faith in the organizations as they currently exist, but the idea of cooperation as a means to resolving conflict as a means to resolving areas of difference in international politics. I think it's really core to the ideals that a lot of feminists hold, and actually a lot of colleagues hold, regardless of whether they call themselves feminists or not. So I think if we're, it's the one good thing I would say that FFP gave to us is the ability to talk quite frankly about feminism and feminist principles. And I think, one of the things that has always been quite generous about feminism itself is that it doesn't, it, feminism thinks everybody should be feminist. But as I always t say to my students, it's the one ism that its whole ambition is to get rid of itself. So we're not actually as bogged down about the names as, and I think the fact that it's the one ism that wants to get rid of itself, is where the power lies. It's why they come after feminism and those ideals, because I think in at the end of the day, it's kind of the ultimate pathways to liberation. And really, that's where I want to end, that feminism is the ultimate pathway to liberation.
Indeed, but feminists, as you were saying, it is about the goal, it is more hierarchical, and we can even get rid of our own terminology if we achieve what we want to achieve. And this is going against also male-dominated mindset and where. So, Tony, it has been an absolute pleasure to talk to you. I hope you can join us to other FEPs activities, and I hope to see you soon in
Absolutely.
one of the many places where we still need to keep fighting for a better and a feminist world, even if other people will not call it that way. So thank you very much. And are you going to the CSW?
No, I'm not going to CSW, but hopefully I will see you in Spain in June for the FFP conference.
Okay, so
Enjoy your time in New
I'll tell
York.
you how it goes. I'm leaving very soon for New York.
Absolutely. Let me know how it goes.
Okay, great. Thank you. Thank you very
Thank
much.
you. Bye.
Bye.